So welcome everyone. Thank you for coming on this Thanksgiving weekend. So before we get into our topic of the day, if there's anyone who is new today or fairly new and has any questions about the meditation that was done today, or about concentration or mindfulness, please feel free to ask it. As well as for those of you who have been attending, I know when I'm not here, various Sangha members give talks. I think, Brian, have you been, you've been giving talks in the past weeks on mindfulness and
emotions and thoughts.
On thoughts and emotions, a ripe and rich topic. So if there are any questions that for those who've been here about what Brian has shared, or in terms of your practicing mindfulness of feelings and mindfulness of emotions, please feel free to ask any questions. So does anybody have any questions? Yes.
My question would be, when I look at meditation in your beginning, I think that what I've learned is that concentration needs to come first before you can derive the call, like deeper meditation or meditation like what we've been learning about for the past few weeks as far as working with emotions and working with thoughts. I actually read that this morning in a book. Like, after you first must establish concentration before you can actually work effectively with emotions and thoughts. But you said that's correct.
So the question is, Chris has been reading things once again. Meditation for Dummies, and in it they mentioned before one can really work with emotions, one has to develop a certain degree of concentration. Or do they say a certain degree of concentration or concentration? Yeah. See, that's where we get dangerous, right? Because we hear words like concentration. And because of the nature of our of the limits of thought, we hear concentration and we hear it as a thing. There's no such thing as concentration, right? I mean, there's right. I mean, there's nothing you can access called concentration. You can't buy concentration, right? You can't seek concentration. It's something that can only be experienced. And it's always experienced in relationship to concentrating on something, right? So concentration does not exist without the person concentrating, without the object that's being concentrated on. And this thing that we call concentration, which is one's mind, one's awareness, is present to something. Right? That is an experience. We could say that the competency grows over time. So in the same way, one might say, just to learn to play the piano and hit the notes correctly, one needs to concentrate. Right. But having said that, there are certainly various degrees of concentration that are needed for mastering certain types of music. But we could say one, in all of them, there has to be a certain level of concentration. The capacity to be present and to be present over time. It is something that is not necessarily developed over here and then applied here. It is something that meets in the middle. over time. So it is certainly true that for very deep, long-term afflictive emotions, for various types of deep habit energy patterns within us, to be able to hold that and to look deeply into it takes a certain competency in the practices of mindfulness and concentration. But that doesn't mean that it is not a skill that can be developed with other types of emotions. Right. And even with the big ones, where you're holding on for dear life, you can have a certain degree of mindfulness and concentration even as you're being pulled along by those emotions. You know, if you wait for your healing and transformation before you become a Buddha, you'll never become a Buddha. A Buddha is somebody who perfectly practices mindfulness and concentration. So when you hear things like, the journey is the path is the journey, you start where you are. You have a set of emotions that are present to you. That is Chris, in now. We all have a certain degree of emotions, various types, and we all have different kinds of minds and different mind states, right? And we are learning to be present to them. The greater our capacity to be present, the greater our capacity to hold them in concentration, the greater capacity we have not to let them do the damage they have done in the past, to lead us down paths which they historically do, and as well to look deeply, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, look deeply to see the fruits if we continue cultivating them and looking in the roots of their causation. That is a lifetime of process. We have to be careful that we don't read too much, and it becomes a reinforcement of our habit energy around discouragement. Not starting something until, I'm too imperfect to do this one. It's not like that. So that is why in this practice we have to be gentle and yet strong, relaxed yet diligent, all these seeming contradictory things, but they're really not. So, what does it all come down to? You do your best. How do you learn to become better at concentration? Only by practicing concentration. Over time, you will see how strong, whether your concentration, your mindfulness and concentration are capable of holding emotions, mind states, in a way that you can see them clearly when they arise. You can note what they are. And yet there's enough distance that even though you are in them, they're not overwhelming you. They're not dragging you along. But even to acknowledge that you're being dragged along, if you're being dragged along, I don't know, how can you be dragged along? You could be dragged along, people fall off horses and, those kind of movies are sort of dragged along or something. Their foot gets caught in the stirrup or something. I don't know if that happens in real life, but I think it happens in the movies. Right? You can be very present and concentrated to that experience. Right? You're not thinking about what you had for breakfast. You're not cursing the horse. You're present to being dragged along. You understand you're being dragged along, and you're trying to figure out a way to get out of it, looking deeply into it. You know, we don't develop concentration and mindfulness in some perfect universe. Most of us don't have that leisure, right? We do not live in caves, we do not live in meditation centers, right? We live in the world. We are lay people. We live in the world. We live in the world of relationships. We live in the world of work. And we live in the world of activity. Lots of activity. So there is a lot going on. It is in this world that we need to learn to discover that this mind has the capacity to just be present to what is occurring without all the elaboration, all the melodrama, all the emotionality, that one can just simply see what's going on and know it. And in that, there is the capability of seeing where things are going. And when you see that, to say, I don't want to go there. In that moment, there's the capacity of seeing that there is another way of responding and dealing. And there's also in that the capacity to see the roots of what is pushing us. But again, it's in learning how to do that that we get better at it, Chris. Right? You don't start with complicated music, do you, if you're learning an instrument? But even if you're doing just scales, you can be 100% concentrated from your first lesson, dealing with the easy stuff, 100% concentrated. Right now, do you know that you're breathing in? Yeah, you have to stop thinking, don't you? Do you notice now that you're breathing? No. Now just watch a moment. Notice you're breathing in. And notice when you breathe out. And notice that you have a body. Can you feel your body? No. And you can even say to yourself, my body is breathing in and out. Do you have an emotion? Are you aware of an emotion going on? Is there a feeling emotion in your body mind right now, Chris? Can you notice that? Mm-hmm. Can you not judge it or do anything like it's bad or good or just notice it? Just be aware of it. And notice at the same time that your body is breathing. Your chest is rising and falling. Can you be aware that there are people around you? There are sounds of the traffic. Yeah, so, you know, thoughts and emotions are just one kind of phenomena. There's lots going on. Mindfulness reveals what's going on. But if we are only focused on the drama, on the melodrama, on the thought, on the emotion, and that's where we're concentrated, I would say your concentration is very good. Chris, I would say you have very highly developed concentration, very great concentrative abilities. You're just misusing them because you're just concentrating, as most of us do, on what? On afflictive emotions, on dramas and melodramas that only produce unhappiness and suffering and anger and fear. So we don't say that we don't have the ability to concentrate. We are concentrating all the time. But what are we concentrating on? And what are the results that come from that type of concentration? Concentrating on that kind of object, we'd say. So we need to see how clearly how important it is that we choose things to concentrate it on that, as was said earlier, produces peace in our minds, that produces positive emotions or feelings. This mind of ours doesn't have a separate mind. It is ours to use or misuse. Right? Garbage in, garbage out. Unfortunately, our mind doesn't have the capacity of saying, stop feeding me junk. Stop feeding me garbage. It hurts. I'm speaking for the mind now. The same way our poor bodies, you know, can't say to us, stop feeding me junk. That's not good for me. Give me nourishment that's good for me. So I can feel good. So I can be healthy. So, you know, the body, you know, it's like when we're having a positive mind state, we might say, I am happy. My mind is happy. Because it's received some good nourishment. We could say feeling healthy is the mind telling, is the body telling us it's happy. But again, our poor bodies do not have a separate, you know, entity that can stick up for it. When we ingest things that are poisonous or toxic or just junk. In the same way, our mind doesn't have that capacity either by itself. It just kind of garbage in, garbage out. There are many people in this world who don't know another way. Their minds are always being filled with garbage, and their life is just a regurgitation of that garbage. Right? So we are fortunate that there are teachings, right, Chris, that tell us about another way. But we have to be very careful that we don't read these teachings and think about these teachings in our garbage way. These teachings and practices from the Buddha for 2,600 years have been given to us to free us and to show us another way. Any other questions? Yes.
My name is Darlene. So I know the teachings So I'm getting evicted this month.
Mm-hmm.
Being evicted at Christmas. And I know the right thing to do, but the garbage line, I want to do all kinds of things to my landlord, her dog, all kinds of stuff.
Right.
You know, but I don't. Thank goodness I've learned enough not to act on it. I used to just act on it.
Mm-hmm.
So you, no matter what, just keep doing positive, and positive is going to come to you. Is that how it's going to work? And every time I have a thought like that, I push it out and bring a good thought in.
So the question is I'm just, I pretty this for the technology runs things. So the question is, I'm in a difficult situation. I'm being evicted. I've learned enough dharma or spiritual practice or meditation that I don't go on paths of anger and violence or acting out that I might have in the past. I do my best, but is that all you do? Just kind of pushing out the bad stuff and trying to bring in the good stuff. Yeah. Well, Darlene, you know, we do our best for where we're at. So when we're in a difficult situation like you're in, your mindfulness reveals to you that there's anger, disappointment, frustration, hurt, fear, right? All anxiety. I mean, all kinds of emotions are arising. Right? Like you say, if we're just a slave of our habit energy, we would act out, right? In many ways, towards the landlord, we may act out ways against ourselves and our own well-being. There are many ways in the past that we act out. What mindfulness allows us to do, right, is to, like you say, to be aware that these mind states are arising in you, that these impulses are arising in you. Okay? And again, it sort of comes to what Chris was saying, you know, to be able to hold them in mindfulness. I am aware that there's hurt, anger, fear, etc. in me. But they are arising where? In you. And for you to acknowledge, you know, when you read the Buddha's teaching, you read a lot about that it's really a path that wants to help us free ourselves from suffering, right? So we can experience happiness or well-being. Right? So when you look inside yourself, you realize, wow, there's a lot of suffering going on inside me, you know? Because it's a difficult situation I'm in. So you want to be present to your suffering. Oftentimes we act out either against someone or against ourselves or do or act in various unhealthy, unskillful, toxic ways, right? Because we find it so uncomfortable to be present to our own uncomfortableness, right? But again, Darlene, if you had a friend who was going through what you were going through, could you listen to her in a very understanding and compassionate way as she told you about her suffering? Yeah, you could. So you have the capacity of holding another's unhappiness, suffering, whatever, in mindfulness and compassion. The hard thing is to learn to do that with ourselves. But that is the practice. Because in doing that, we are now on a path of liberation rather than a path of continuing to suffer. Because like you said, you understand that if you do not hold this tenderly with understanding and compassion and mindfulness, if you let it run riot, like it has in the past, you can see the fruits of that, which will be what? If you act out in violence or whatever words against your landlord, will that solve your problem? No. Will that has a potential of increasing? Yes, it does. Oh, you know what that's called, Darlene? Wisdom. It's finally beginning to dawn, right? Meditation for dummies. Even dummies like ourselves can begin to get a little less dumb. Right? That's wonderful, isn't it? That's on the path. And again, when you are somewhat calm and not in the throes of emotion, you know, you want to be able to use these capacities of our mind for looking deeply, for insight, for understanding, to kind of look at the situation, the roots of it. You know, how did I get to where I am? Right? How did this situation arise? Right? So you can understand or hopefully see that there are other ways that things can play out. I mean, that's not always the case. Sometimes we're just caught in something that we just have to deal with, right? I mean, lots of relationships are like that. Physical things, diseases. I mean, sometimes we're just, you know, something's just arising that we just have to deal with. Do you want to send them love? No. Well, stop that. This is Buddhism is not a path of guilt. So you're bringing that with you. Okay. Buddhism is a path of understanding. Okay. And I would see again. You would see that's these are moments. See, we always have these moments where transformation is possible. But it has to be real, right? Can't, you know, you don't want to create some airy-fairy, yeah. I mean, a lot of people think, you know, spirituality is like, you know, putting up flowery wallpaper in a filthy room. It's not that. It's, you know, it's realizing I'm in a filthy room. Right? I'm in a filthy room. Let me just start there. You know. Do I want to live in a filthy room? It's an interesting question, you see. Do I want to live in a filthy room? What kind of room do I want to live in? Or maybe I want to live in a clean room. Oh. And really, the first thing to do is to start cleaning up before putting on the flower wallpaper. Anybody ever paint a wall that wasn't cleaned first? Not a good job. Yeah. So this gives you an opportunity to stop and go, wow. Truth is, my mind is full of what? Anger, hurt, disappointment. Yeah. So let me be with that and understand that. What are the roots of my own anger? My own hurt, my own disappointment, my own sense of betrayal, right? Lots of things come up. And this may not be the first time you've been there. So the roots within our own minds lie deep. And maybe the first person you need to generate loving kindness and compassion for is who? Yeah, because you're the one who's suffering. See how crazy it is? We're suffering, but we're sending lots of loving kindness to all these suffering beings out there. Right? Like somehow that's my practice. There's somebody who's suffering very close to home. Well, She needs to be taken care of. Right? And in time, you may want to send loving kindness to this person that you believe has harmed you. But, you know, when you're ready. Okay? Yeah. Any questions, any other questions about the practice that we do and how to apply them to life? You see how dangerous is we hear these teachings and we put them over us. Right? Like a straitjacket. Our spiritual dharma practice supposed to liberate us becomes another straitjacket. But we're really proud of it because we're because we think it's noble and Buddhism is about liberation from the inside. And the inside, as Darlene has told us and Chris has told us, can often be messy. A lot of jobs in life are messy. Right? But, you know, there are people who enjoy cleaning up messes. You know, and get a great satisfaction out of that. When one can be cleaning up a mess and be happy. Right? One can be cleaning up a mess and be joyful. You know, one knows it's a mess, but one has the tools to clean it up. Yeah, how wonderful. I don't have to live in a mess forever. I can clean it up. That should make us happy. That should give us purpose, meaning, all these things. Any other questions about practice? So, for those of you who are new, for the past, since October, we, our whole community, in all the various sanghas and on the phone, I mean, in other places who are part of our community, we have been looking for the last 3 months, including December, into these fundamental practice of mindfulness, living from the inside out. We have 80-some people who are members of our community who are involved in a thing called an intensive, which is involving daily practices and study and readings and meetings with me and meetings with other people in who are also in this, quote, intensive. We are using this book, Transformation and Healing, by Thich Nhat Hanh. It's a commentary on this very early but very fundamental teaching of the Buddha called The Four Foundations of Mindfulness, as well as Thich Nhat Hanh's book called Happiness, which is really a compilation of many of his some of them fairly standard, but many of them very creative ways of bringing the practices of mindfulness, healing, transformation into all the aspects of daily life, relationships, etc. So it's a kind of a twofold. But beginning in December, for those of us in the intensive, the four foundations of mindfulness, for those of you who've been with us a while or who know, and again, for those who aren't, please catch up. The first one has to do with mindfulness. The first foundation is to create a foundation of mindfulness in the body, in the breath. There's a wisdom to the Buddha beginning in the body breath. As anybody has looked into their minds, they see, wow, a lot going on there. Sometimes it's a pretty scary place, out of control place. So let us begin in the body. The body is very physical. It is made up simply of sensations. Thinking does not go on in the body. Emotions are driven by the mind. So the body is a wonderful place to learn to be mindful. The body and the senses which are in the body are always in the present. So it is a wonderful place to learn about living in the present. So the Buddha begins with training us in mindfulness of our body and our breath. It is a wonderful ground. Also, I think as Americans of the 21st century, we have lost our connection with our body and with our senses. We are lost, endlessly lost, in mental stimulation and emotional volatility. You know, it is a drama that begins from the time we wake up to the time we go to bed, and if we're not careful, it'll wake us up in the night. We are out of balance. So we need to come back to our bodies. So we begin in mindfulness of the body. Then the second establishment of mindfulness, and I'm sure this is, I mean, I've talked about it and other talks, and there's talks on the YouTube and all stuff like that, is we enter the mind when we just notice that the mind and the body has this very simplistic response to everything it encounters, both physical and mental, which is it finds it pleasant, it finds it unpleasant, or it finds it neutral. That begins before all action, thought, emotion take place. There is this very simple kind of pleasant, unpleasant, like, dislike, neutral, moving toward, moving away from, kind of unconscious response, we might say. Much of which has been conditioned by ourselves. It is a pusher of our behavior, of our words, of our emotions, of our thoughts, and we don't see it. So this noticing, this very elemental movement of the mind and body towards or away from, before endless confabulations of thought arise, is the second establishment of mindfulness. It's called Vedana. And then the third establishment of mindfulness, which we're beginning, is called mindfulness of the mind in the mind. And here the Buddha is talking about mind states, such as anger, fear, such as happiness, joy, such as constricted, open, tense, relaxed, trusting, doubting. So in Buddhist psychology, when we talk about mindfulness of the mind, it doesn't simply mean just observing the momentary arisings of thoughts, feelings, perceptions, you know, the activity of the mind. It's also meaning it's giving us a way to look at it. And it kind of lumps things together. Right? So as the capacity to say, you know, each of us, I mean, every emotion has a storyline attached to it often. The storyline is usually our justification for experiencing it. We are very good, have you noticed, at always justifying our view of things. We are very good at justifying our emotions, even when they are afflictive. So in mindfulness of the mind in the mind, the Buddha is showing us a way to be aware of what's arising in our mind, but in this kind of intelligent way. I'm aware that there's anger in me. I'm aware that there is agitation in me. My mind is agitated. See, it doesn't mean we're always focused on what we're agitated about. We're always focused on what we're angry about, what we're fearful of. But we're not looking at it in this, I think, much more intelligent way, which is saying these are all afflictive emotions. Forget about how you're justifying them. And we are very sophisticated in justifying why we should be having them. And why we should continue to have them. But in the way we're looking at the mind this way, we are noting that there are a whole series of mind states that we might say are afflictive. They're negative. They are restricting. They are constricting. They are the product. They will produce unhappiness. They will produce ill-being. And at the same time, there are a whole series of mind states that produce the opposite, that produce well-being, that produce a peaceful mind, that produces calmness, that produces a sense of wholeness, that produces happiness, well-being. Is that clear? And so we're learning to look at these endless arisings of our mind in a very simplistic way, but yet I think very important way. If we're in this for healing and transformation, right? If we're in it just to put wallpaper, a little covering over the dirt, then who needs this practice? Like you say, I'll just push down all the bad stuff and do loving kindness meditation over it. If that's our practice, then this is not what the Buddha is talking about. He's talking about in mindfulness of the mind, in the mind, to really be present to what is arising in our mind and see clearly. Because he also says, when you see these mind states, have enough concentration, like Chris says, that one can see their fruits and see their causes. Fruits mean, you know, it's like Darlene was saying, you know, if I maintain this anger, if I act out on this anger, where's it going to get me? Right? You know, if it's true what I say, that I want to be, I want to have a happy mind, I want to have a peaceful mind, I want to have a loving mind, I want to have a compassionate mind, you know what I'm saying? And I'd say most people probably in this room are here because they'd say yes. But if we would be practicing full awareness of the mind in the mind, and we would see that there are many mind states that we are maintaining, we are upholding, we're concentrating on, which will not produce that. On the other hand, we will see, hopefully throughout the day, that there are many times throughout the day when my heart is light. When compassion or loving kindness or happiness has arisen in me, right? That my mind is content. It's not desiring anything. It's not needing anything. It's okay right now. And we would be noting that and be aware of that and seeing what that feels like. So mindfulness of the mind in the mind, noticing these basic movements of the mind and where they lead and where they come from, is really a fundamental aspect of this practice of transformation. It is why we are cultivating mindfulness and concentration and insight. We are not cultivating mindfulness and concentration and insight like in some abstract world to become, Dharma people. We are cultivating mindfulness, concentration, and insight to facilitate healing and transformation in ourselves and in the world. right? You know, I mean, Chris, you could, you know, go off to some retreat place and just cultivate concentration, right? Very focused. And you could stay there for 3 years. And at the end of those 3 years, you could say, whew, I've mastered concentration. I'm still unhappy, but I've mastered concentration. My mental formations, all my conditioning is still very present to me. But as long as I stay concentrated, right? So we have to be very careful that we do not turn our spiritual practice into some kind of exercise regime, you know, that we're becoming good at. Again, this is a practice that is about producing, you know, happiness is so overused, but, you know, that's why I sort of like well-being, just this sense of well-being. My being is well. All is good. Happy. Content. Able to enjoy life. Able to be present to the suffering of myself and others. Are there any questions about that? Yes.
Can you just say a little bit about
Right, so yeah, keep going. You'll answer your own question. You don't need me. Right, so Steve just answered his own question about how do you at the one time have that aspiration, but at the other time you do have to, you know, become more competent at these practices. How do you not turn them into, and he said, well, maybe you have to sort of be doing them both together. And you got it. Right. So and you've heard me talk about this many times, you know, the really key thing in Dharma practice is aspiration. What is my aspiration? Why am I doing this? If your aspiration, and your aspiration, the cultivation of aspiration is not something we do once in our life, right? It's something we do constantly. Right? We wake up with it. My aspiration for today is to what? To live in mindfulness. My aspiration of today is to live in selflessness and kindness. Right? My aspiration of today, you know, these are my aspirations. My aspiration for today is to be of benefit to others, not just live for myself. Right? So one's aspiration is something that should inform our daily life. When we undertake our practices of meditation, whatever, it is very traditional in Buddhism that when one first sits down, one says, I undertake this practice to be of benefit to all beings. So again, even in the practice, you know, when you pick up a book to read, you just take a moment, you know, a Dharma book or something, to say to yourselves, you know, I'm undertaking this practice to deepen my understanding so I can liberate myself from my own suffering and be of benefit to others. I mean, that took how long? 20 seconds? You know, but to have that capacity in all one's interchanges throughout the day to keep your aspiration alive so it's always connected to what you're doing. It's very simple, but it's very profound. Because again, if we don't if we don't have that fundamental aspiration or motivation for why we're undertaking these practices, and if it's not with us all the time, it can become, like you say, it can be mechanical, it can become competitive, it can have no juice, it can be just another ego game. You know, how am I doing? Did I get an A today? Good meditation, A plus. Bad meditation, D minus. I'm a good person, I'm a bad person. I'm a good practitioner, I'm a bad, you know? That's all the manufacture, the fabrication of ego, of self, right? And if we're not careful, we'll get into that. But if we keep our aspiration pure, that whatever I do, it's to the benefit of others. I'm not here to benefit myself, right? For most people, they spend a whole life only thinking about themselves, and it always, you know, and even though they're surrounded by their stuff, they're still unhappy. Because selfishness does not create happiness. Self-centeredness doesn't do it. It only gives a momentary sense when the self feels it's accomplished what it's wanted, it has a momentary sense of happiness. But it set it up that way. Of course, it has a lot of unhappiness when things don't work out the way it wants. And it's never at peace. There's no peace in selfishness. Is there? There's no well-being in selfishness. Selfishness means I'm only concerned about myself. Now, for those who have, you know, kind of binary minds, that doesn't mean that you never think of yourself, right? Darlene's got to take care of herself, doesn't she? And she has some choices and decisions to make, right? So it doesn't mean it's not self-abnegation. It's not that either. It's that balance. My purpose of being here is to be of benefit to people, to free them from their sufferings and help them walk in an enlightened way. And that includes who? That includes me too. I'm a self too. So it becomes over time seamless. Your work to benefit yourself, to work to benefit others are the same. Your work to bring light and joy and happiness and well-being in the world is the same as bringing that into your own life. They're the same. Any questions? Yes. Again, I thought they could hear. Okay, so the question was, through my practice, I am becoming more open to people, life, emotions, and it feels vulnerable. I don't like that word. It feels very vulnerable, right? Is that the question?
Yeah.
Are you in contact with this person? Can they hear me?
Yes. Sir.
Yeah, what does that mean? What does she mean by vulnerable? When she says the word vulnerable, what does she actually mean by that word? Oh, she's typing to you?
She's typing that.
Oh.
Unprotected.
What are we scared of? And who's scared? Yeah. Does our body have a problem with being open to everything? I mean, what does that mean? Does our body have a problem being open to everything? No. Our body is present to whatever happens. Right? So what is it that says, protect me? This is too much for me. I'm going to be overwhelmed. What is that? It's interesting. See, in Buddhism, we don't just run with it. We stop. We hold it in mindfulness. And we look deeply. What is this that says, openness, scary? Yeah, I'd still say, what is that in us? Because our minds, in just awareness, is capable of being aware of everything, right? Mindfulness is capable of being mindful of everything, right? It can look at a beautiful thing, it can look at a, quote, ugly thing, and it'll just see it. Beautiful, ugly. So the mind's awareness is able to hold everything. The body is able to be present to everything. So what is it that says, this is too much? I can't take this. What is that? It's not the body. It's not awareness of the mind. What is it that says, this is too much for me? I'm scared. Danger. Protect me. What is that? Anybody have any idea what that is? What? Just a mind state, ego, feeling, ego, self, thought. Yes.
I'm aware of it as an outcome of safety in the body, but if it's in the bottom.
I think there is a survival instinct in the body that is conditioned to react to danger. I don't think this person is talking about real danger. This is important, yeah. I mean, having a body, there's a certain capacity of the body that it just intuitively reacts to things that really threaten its existence. Yeah, but we're not talking about this. We're talking about something that's of the mind, that's psychological. What if I told you that our natural state is a state of openness, of fearlessness, free of anxiety, free of separation, and that sense of being overwhelmed is only because there's something that's trying to control things, that wants it a certain way and says, I can handle this, I can't handle this. This I can handle, this is too much for me. What's saying that? If we turn around and look in our minds to where that voice is coming from, you may be surprised what you see. Things arise and pass. That's all that's going on. Thoughts arise and pass away. Feelings arise and pass away. Right. Every day, different news in the newspaper. Things are just arising and passing, internally and externally. None of them are solid or permanent, right? If one learns just to be present, to hold things just in awareness, not to pick and choose and judge, and certainly not to live life from the point of view of a self, it's a very different world. One, you know, sometimes people say funny things, you know that? They say, ooh, open-heartedness, too much. Got to parcel it out, you know. Ooh, my heart will break if it expands that much. That's not the way it is. Now, how do we know that? Because there are people in this world, like Buddhas, like Christ, like other great beings, who show us that the human heart has the capability of loving unconditionally. Spiritual teachers and masters show us our potential, and so do infants and children. We're stuck in the middle somewhere. Hang around little children. They have a wonderful capacity to be present and open. They just look. So good. Thank you for coming. We'll stop here.